This is Speaking of Shakespeare, conversations about things Shakespearean. I'm Thomas Dabbs, broadcasting from Aoyama Gakuin University in central Tokyo. If you are joining us on YouTube and wish to listen to this program as a podcast, you may click the link below to your favorite podcast platform. This talk is with Michael Dobson, director of the Shakespeare Institute, University of Birmingham, and located appropriately in Stratford-upon-Avon. We will begin by talking about the Shakespeare Institute's programs and mission, and also about Michael's own research, most recently, on Shakespeare in the repertories of national theater companies worldwide. This series is funded with support from the Aoyama Gakuin University Institute of the Humanities, and also with a generous grant from the Japan Society for the Promotion of Science. Michael, we are absolutely delighted. I say this to every speaker, but we are very delighted to have you here. We had to, I don't think we had to drag you back from travels, but you've been on travels, and we want to talk about that at some point here. But first, you are the director of the Shakespeare Institute in Stratford-upon-Avon. And this institute is with the University of Birmingham, but it's a satellite campus in the beautifully appointed town of Stratford-upon-Avon. And we wanted to welcome you to this program.
Thank you. It's a great pleasure to be here.
I think we should start here. You are the director, so it's incumbent that you begin by telling us something about the Institute. I know here in Japan, I have several younger colleagues who are recent graduates. I have a student who is coming back who has been there for the past year and a half or so. But let's start with talking about the Institute and its programs and missions.
Yeah, well, it's a very curious institution. It has a kind of a double identity in that it is merely, actually, a little tiny lost sub-department of the University of Birmingham. It's about an hour from the rest of the university because the traffic is so ghastly across the Midlands nowadays. Yes, the very fringe of the University of Birmingham. We're not even the English Literature Department. We're a little unit, an academic unit, to use the term, delivering programs, which simply happens to be based in Stratford-upon-Avon. We teach a range of master's courses, and we have a resident community of PhD students. Mm-hmm. When the Institute was first set up in 1951, it was all postdocs. I mean, there weren't even doctoral students at first. It was just a research establishment with very few people there. And the people who were there tended to actually live in the building because the Institute is based in what was the very nice 18th century house of a mad Edwardian novelist called Marie Corelli, who in her time was very, very famous, was visited by Mark Twain and Sarah Bernhardt and Ellen Terry and all sorts of other luminaries. So the Institute has this beautiful building and is always in danger of being forgotten by the rest of the University of Birmingham, and sometimes worse still, is in danger of being remembered by the rest of the University of Birmingham, who, you know, would prefer things to be more uniform and slightly less eccentric than a small house full of people who are obsessed with Shakespeare is liable to be. We have inherited various aims, aspirations, and missions from before the university actually bought the building and actually set up the Institute. The house of Marie Corelli, the Edwardian novelist, did belong to the British Council for a while. The soft power encouraging people to like English literature around the world in the hopes that this will make them more pliable sort of establishment, which has very little budget left nowadays, and nowadays is mainly involved in language teaching. So the building was the British Council's place in Stratford, where visiting dignitaries and visiting artists could be entertained and taken to the theatre. And in that building, they set up residential Shakespeare courses with what was then the Shakespeare Memorial Theatre, the big theatre in the middle of Stratford. This is in the 40s. Mm. In 1951, the University of Birmingham, in a moment of vision, decided that they would bribe Allardyce Nicol, the great Glaswegian theatre historian who'd gone to Yale to set up their drama department between the wars. They would bribe him to come back and work for the University of Birmingham by saying, look, if you come and work for us, we will let you set up your very own Shakespeare Institute in Stratford if you'll do the fundraising. And this Allardyce Nicol, who was an amazingly accomplished man, did. The university got a huge donation from a biscuit manufacturer in Birmingham. They bought the building, the former British Council headquarters, and set it up as the institute with Allardyce Nicol as its founding director. And Nicol was a friend of Barry Jackson, the great Birmingham philanthropist and theatrical visionary who set up the Birmingham Repertory Theatre, who did those pioneering modern dress productions of Shakespeare in between the wars, and who was in the late 40s the artistic director of the theatre in Stratford. And he was the man who appointed a young university near dropout called Peter Brook to some of his first directing jobs in 48. So one of the things that the Institute was supposed to do was to provide a kind of learned think tank for the theatre. There would be people there who knew about the Elizabethan theatre, who could provide advice and any odd errands they could do for the theatre that was the other big thing in Stratford, and also for the Shakespeare Birthplace Trust, which of course has the job of curating Shakespeare's houses, curating Stratford, really, for the town. The other thing that the Institute inherited, apart from the British Council's sense that it would be good to have proper residential academic courses on Shakespeare as part of what Stratford was offering to the world, was that they had set up the International Shakespeare Conference, again in the late 40s, a gathering of the great minds of Shakespeare studies from all around the world, or that was its remit. And they would have a conference periodically, and its proceedings would be amplified into papers and would be published in a newly founded annual called Shakespeare Survey, mm-hmm. which was invented for this very purpose, with the Shakespeare Institute, as it became, as its mailing address. So the Institute has this role of appearing to the outside world to be the world epicenter of Shakespeare studies, this kind of secular college of cardinals that sits in Stratford, tells the theatre what to do, spreads the word of the latest discoveries and trends in Shakespeare studies, and draws people from all over the world, draws intellectuals to Stratford, as well as more middle-brow tourists. That's what it sort of looks like from the outside. And in fact, because of it has such a wonderful name, the Shakespeare Institute. I mean, it sounds so secure and authoritative and important. That's how it looks from if you're looking at it from outside the management of the University of Birmingham. We continually are deluged nowadays, now that everybody can find our email addresses online, with all sorts of random questions about Shakespeare, random theories about Shakespeare, phone calls from the press. I mean, fairly typically, in a very busy day at my office yesterday, I was phoned by two national newspapers asking me to comment on the latest alleged portrait of Shakespeare that somebody is publicizing. This happens all the time, and people are forever sending me the manuscripts of their four-page books about which obscure person really wrote the Shakespeare canon, and how they're probably in league with Hillary Clinton and so forth. So it's another thing about the name Shakespeare Institute. Elsewhere in the world, there is something called the Goethe Institute, and there is something called the Cervantes Institute. The Goethe Institute is the German equivalent of the British Council. It funds the dissemination of German high culture worldwide. It's really part of the German state. Ditto the Cervantes Institute, which helps people understand Spanish culture and funds programs in, you know, studying Lope de Vega, wherever you may be on the planet. So people see, oh, the Shakespeare Institute, that must be the same thing. I mean, I got a message not long before the pandemic saying, oh, we're about to stage the first ever production of Hamlet in the Faroe Islands, translated into Faroese. And of course, the Shakespeare Institute will want to fund it. You know, I can fantasize all I like about having a budget at the Institute's own discretion by which we just invest in new translations of Shakespeare plays being staged all over the world. But sadly, that's not quite how things are. I managed to put them in touch with a couple of friends of mine who were free to go over and see it. And it sounds like it was a great show. But alas, it did not have our name as financial backers on the bottom of it. We are, I think, the only university department entirely devoted to Shakespeare. Mm-hmm. And because we are in Stratford and therefore have access to the Shakespeare Birthplace Trust Library, because we have our own library, which has been hand-picked since 1951 just for the better comfort and convenience of Shakespeare scholars, and because the University of Birmingham has a fabulous library and collection itself, including a first folio and a lot of other stuff, we do have really very, very good resources for research on Shakespeare. It's a very, very good place to get access to things, primary things as well as secondary things. I mean, actors and directors give us their archives to look after. So there's a lot of hitherto unstudied stuff that our students can be working on and editing and studying and so on.
And an absolutely splendid faculty there.
We try. I'm not at all displeased with the appointments, with the team who were already there when I came more than 10 years ago now, nor with the people we've appointed since. Most recently, our first Japanese speaker. We've just permanently hired Jessica Chiba, who was with us as a postdoc, and who, you know, she's half Japanese. She's a native speaker of Japanese. Yeah. She's working on translation. She's very much part of the Institute's continuing remit to be international, to know how Shakespeare looks from a lot of places outside schoolrooms in the Anglophone world.
Yes.
So we have a lot of activities with institutions around the world that we share and work with.
Oh, you surely do. And even in my small little liberal arts college back in the medieval period, I studied at the Shakespeare Institute before it was affiliated with the University of Birmingham. I'm dating myself, but what a splendid experience. We spent a month there and we got to see the entire repertoire that year. And then names.
I'm fascinated that you studied there without knowing that it has always been a department of the University of Birmingham.
I didn't know that. I mean, it was. It didn't have the master's program, though, I don't think, at that time. Uh-huh. This would have been 78, Michael.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
So so it was at that time with Birmingham. And, you know, I was a little boy from the American South, you know, young. I just completely overwhelmed by the theater. The other place was in a building that looked at it like it had been put up, you know, in a day. Aluminum siding and that sort of thing.
Yeah.
And you went in there and you were sitting 1 meter away from the actors.
Yeah.
And you're thinking, are these people part of the audience? And they start acting. And you see that. And then the Swan wasn't there yet.
It was 86, the Swan.
We would have our little lectures and the actors would come over. And the actors, Patrick Stewart.
Yeah, yeah.
And, Jonathan Pryce and Peter Brooks, Antony and Cleopatra.
Yes. that with are Alan just Alan Rickman as the messenger.
Alan Rickman as the messenger. And there were several productions there that just, the experience of being there is just imprinted, tattooed on your memory. You never forget it.
And it's one of the things that I think the Institute should be proud of, that it was one of the first university departments to take the expertise of theatre people really seriously.
Yes.
Universities had given honorary degrees to celebrity actors, but really to please the students. The Institute has always involved theatre people in its teaching. Judy Dench became an honorary fellow of the Institute early on. And Janet Suzman, Vivian Heilbron, Sir Simon Russell Beale, Kenneth Branagh, we have a lot of Ken's archive, and fairly typical day yesterday, I was teaching an MA seminar, and most of the teaching was done by Kelly Hunter, MBE, who's a very distinguished RSC performer and now runs her own company, Flute Theatre. That sense that it's not that Shakespeare is literature, which occasionally gets vulgarized by show business people, but that, this was always popular drama, that what you want is actors who know how to read and literary students who understand theater. Every student at the Institute is automatically a member of the Drama Society, whether they choose to perform or not.
Yes.
It's just part of the life of the community.
And you just learn so much because of the closeness of the community there. You can go across to the famous pub, the Dirty Duck, or the Black Swan, or whatever, and the longstanding. But it just has been there forever, still there. You can talk to an actor, and they are happy to do that. If you're not acting like an idiot, and I did, and I do remember one guy who said, in Shakespeare, I get all of these lines to tell a woman how much I love her, to tell the actor how much I love her. And he said, I was watching a Clint Eastwood movie. And, back in that time, we were thinking, oh, Clint Eastwood is in for dig, da, da, da. And I secretly loved those revenge stories, because of the Jacobean theater. And he said to me, what a cracking good actor. He can do it in one line. Mm-hmm. I thought, oh my, well, I've been vindicated, But just little tidbits of things like that, these little moments that you you get a peek inside and you see how hard these people work.
Yeah.
How hard they work.
Yeah, yeah. You get much more to say. I mean, Shakespeare is, by comparison to the average, even theatre script now, verbose. You get far more to actually say and far longer sentences to say. You do need to be in physical shape to keep those words coming, as well as in intellectual shape to keep them sounding like they mean something and that it's you who's meaning them. It is a wonderful training doing a lot of Shakespeare as a young actor. That's one reason why young actors still want to come and work at the RSC.
Yeah. Oh, they love it. They do it. And I mentioned Patrick Stewart. I remember him jogging by our little B&B, and it's freezing cold outside.
Yeah.
And he had on his little sock hat, and he's jogging. Yeah. And I'd say he's in his mid-30s, and he's not a mainstream actor. I mean, this could be it. He's doing it, and I know how hard they worked and how much. And it's just a quarter turn of the screw. Something happens. You get a break, and there he is, international fame.
No, there was that moment. There was that moment when actors who'd been in the RSC in the 60s and 70s suddenly all became film stars in unison, weirdly. in the late 80s.
Yes.
Judy gets into the Bond films. McKellen does his Richard III movie and gets all those sci-fi villain parts. Patrick Stewart gets the Star Trek gig. I saw a great deal of Patrick's work when he was with the RSC. I think he's been better since Star Trek. I think Star Trek was good for him. I mean, his Antony, I liked his Antony much better than I liked his Ina Barbas when he came back.
I remember his Ina Barbas. I remember Shylock also.
He
had me,
No, he was always good. I didn't like his Leontes so much, but He was a very funny Titus. He did a sort of black comedy Titus, as I recall.
Yeah, Titus. That play that's hard to watch.
Years later,
I saw it.
Though it's, you know, I've been lucky. I've seen some very, very good productions of Titus, often not in English, which seems to help somehow. The Ninagawa Titus was great. The Jan Klatter Titus, which was a production in which he cast a Polish company as the Goths and a German company as the Romans, performing in their respective languages.
Yeah.
It was deliberately very, very provocative, and it was all about the vicious national stereotypes that each entertains about the other. It was a fantastic show, the most extreme piece, one of the most extreme pieces of sort of purposeful black comedy I think I've ever seen. The Polish government sent the Home Office minister to speak in a post-show Q&A to sort of reassure everybody that this was all right. it was a great show. It was in Gdansk.
Well, we're segueing a little bit. I did want to, you know, the idea of the Institute is just intertwined with the theater. It can't help but be. It's just steps away.
And we have a formal collaboration agreement now, so that actually some of our courses are co-taught with the RSC. You know, we have a Shakespeare and Creativity program where our students get to perform in the RSC's foyers. They put on kind of multimedia events to a brief set by the RSC to fit in with the ideas that are being debated in that particular season. So they get to work with RSC creatives and directors and designers, as well as with the RSC's very large and very impressive education department, which, you know, helps train those of our MA students who are specifically studying how to teach Shakespeare.
And there's something for everyone in Stratford. It's not a big town, but the theater scene there, just the delightful nature when the weather's good, in particular with the river and so forth. But you've been talking a lot about the kind of outreach work that you do, just as necessarily, as you're saying, there is that name. But I think there's also your interest and a longstanding interest in the global reception of Shakespeare, adaptations of Shakespeare. And you go all over the place, and you are working on a book on Shakespeare in repertories of national theaters.
Yeah.
And let's focus on that for a moment, and then I want to talk a bit about your travels.
As you'll already have gathered, I spent much of my youth, once I had first been taken to Stratford compulsorily on a bus as a 15-year-old to see Terry Hand's production of Henry V, going to see plays, going to see Shakespeare done, whether in London or particularly in Stratford. I was a student in Oxford. You could get to Stratford quite easily, and I did. Anglophone Shakespeare to me meant the RSC and the National Theatre Company. It meant Shakespeare done pretty much full text in English, in ways that were influenced by modernism, that had gone back to open stages. And I thought it was about great Anglophone actors. And it was really only when I started doing research into when Shakespeare became such an important kind of totem, or, you know, had such cultural value and symbolic value for Britain in particular during the 18th century, that I began to realize how much our sense of Shakespeare was shaped by much bigger currents of intellectual change and theatrical change and artistic change right through Europe, and in what happened when you transplanted Shakespeare into colonies in the New World and in India and in Africa. And it was really only when I got back from America, because, you know, my wife, Professor Nikki Watson, and I worked in the States for 10 years. Mm-hmm. And it was only when we came back that we really had much time to travel, not just to other English speaking places around the New World, which we'd been doing, going to conferences and all those other things we did, but actually going and getting involved in this new thing that has become the European Shakespeare Research Association, where non-Anglophones who teach English-speaking literature and who do Shakespeare were beginning to organize to compare notes about the reception history of Shakespeare in their own territories, their own bits of the world. And I got involved round about that period too. I got invited to China and got interested in Asian Shakespeare. You know, we both went out to China, we saw Chinese theatre, we met a lot of Chinese scholars. And that sense of Shakespeare, when Shakespeare becomes the first author who is pointed to when people are coming up with a notion of world literature, mm-hmm. that there might be a kind of canon of writers that you're supposed to have read in translation, even if you don't speak very many languages yourself, that sense that Shakespeare, our Shakespeare, is shaped by the Enlightenment, by neoclassicism, by these very different translations of Shakespeare, which mold him to different forms and different presuppositions about what's entertaining and what's meaningful. That began to impinge on my sense of what I'd been writing about, which was, you know, this parochial stuff about what happens to Shakespeare in England, which is very largely how Shakespeare is rewritten to make him more like Molière and Racine for a certain period in reception. And it's been incredibly refreshing to see Shakespeare performed and read about histories of Shakespeare and see monuments to Shakespeare even, which aren't overshadowed by the Anglophone tradition of making Shakespeare sort of compulsory, investing a certain kind of a story about rootedness, which is partly what Stratford props up. It's a very misleading story, but that sense that Shakespeare is our indigenous culture and nobody else can really understand it, which is just plainly untrue once one, you know, goes over to Germany or France or South Korea or wherever else it may be and sees far more nuanced and exciting and fresh and intelligent and live performances of Shakespeare than the ones one often sees done for buses full of school children back in England. So that was a sort of general widening experience. In a way, I mean, a lot of people, they find a topic of research which really speaks to them, and then they go on producing the same book over and over again. This is something I've tried to avoid without success, though I've at least been consistent in that my first book is a book which nobody will ever set as set reading for an undergraduate course. I mean, why would they? It's a book about the 18th century reception of Shakespeare. There are no undergraduate courses on that. Nobody even teaches 18th century literature anymore very much. You know, I don't want to write mug's guides for undergraduates or just the usual stuff that goes in an Arden introduction. There are plenty of other people to do that.
No, that book is close to my heart, Michael. You know,
I assume it must be close to mine since I bothered to write it.
Well, there's a connection here because Garrick and they made Shakespeare, and Shakespeare made them. Yeah. They could not have had the repertory without that raw material and that already pre-made. And that gave, just like in Stratford, you can bring in new plays and so forth. And you see this worldwide. And I think that's probably the underlying theme of your research, that these repertories are not colonized by, you know, whether in Japan or whether in China or whatnot. They're driven by this respected foreign force that is then made indigenous, right?
And they are often energized by the same kind of nation building patterns that were going on in Britain in the 18th century. This sense that we are going to identify ourselves as speakers of a particular language, enthusiasts for a particular kind of culture to which we are all entitled by understanding it, rather than being governed by, you know, some ruling dynasty from somewhere else. You know, the nation's going to be organized as a cultural entity, a linguistic entity, rather than just as a territory number three of this particular empire or monarchy or whatever it may be. Now, there are terrible things can go wrong with either of the models. You know, you can have rather plural and rather liberal empires, though not all the time, not often. And you can have very repressive nations who say, well, look, the important thing about the nation is that we all speak one language and we all have one common culture. And therefore, anybody living here who doesn't shall be denied their rights and persecuted and kicked out. But they're both of these models can do things with Shakespeare and because Shakespeare writes in a period when nationhood is very fluid and debated and it's not quite obvious where England fits, whether it's going to be an absolutely feudal monarchy, whether the distinguishing thing about it is that it speaks English, which is a language nobody else speaks and which is a mess of other languages anyway, or whether it's going to be a kind of piratical offshore trading bootleg nation that goes in for argument and doesn't obey the literary rules. You know, those things are all possible raw materials, as you say, in Shakespeare's scripts. And different theatres and different makers of theatrical national institutions have found productive things to do with them. I mean, there are any number of countries in Europe that have seized upon Shakespeare as not the culture of the foreign ruling class. Germany, Poland, Ukraine, these have all translated Shakespeare and said, you know, this is a kind of literature that speaks to us, especially Hamlet, because, you know, there he is, this dissident struggling against a corrupt, slightly foreign-looking monarchy that has Swiss mercenaries at its disposal and is usurping, and he's trying to be Hamlet the Dane, and it's terribly tragic that he isn't. Everywhere you go in 19th century Europe, there are sort of radical nationalist visions of Hamlet trying to happen or succeeding in happening, and you know it's still happening now. I mean, in 2012, the first Afghan translation of Hamlet. To prove that our language is fit for this masterpiece, and it gives us a kind of intellectual independence. And you know, when I was in Ukraine in 2018, I saw the most extraordinary Hamlet done in the cellar underneath a huge Soviet era theatre building in Ivano-Frankivsk that was very black comic, very kind of zombie. I mean, the characters were all already dead and kept coming back to life. It was sort of influenced by no drama that way. But it was all about, they were having a national Shakespeare festival. And it was all about their right to do Shakespeare in Ukrainian, now that Ukraine was independent, now that Ukraine had chosen a Western-looking, liberal-looking government after all that time. And it's been one of the traumatic things about this fairly traumatic year, hearing from the people there in Ivano-Frankivsk about how they are using that cellar as an air raid shelter, and still occasionally performing that Hamlet to entertain people who are sheltering in that theatre. It's a very, very national theatre at the point at which it is, working as an air raid shelter as part of the war effort. And when Hamlet comes back to life for the last time in that production to recite To Be or Not to Be as an epilogue, having already spoken it in context earlier on, and when they do it now, because Zelensky quoted it, Hamlet drapes a Ukrainian flag over his shoulders. I mean, it's become one of the most explicitly nationalist Hamlets to go into the book.
That's going to be there. Oh my. Well, all right. So we're situated, and I know that, within our little family, we can get into some family disputes about at what point Shakespeare stops becoming Shakespeare. And I wanted you to make a couple of comments about that. You know, at what point is there a point where you go, okay, this isn't Shakespeare at all, or we shouldn't call this Shakespeare? Where on that spectrum?
If it's good, I don't care, to be honest. I mean, at what point did it stop being the old Lear play and become King Lear? I mean, how many lines and motifs did Shakespeare have to change? I'm not one of those people who says, well, once you've translated Shakespeare, you're talking about something else entirely. Shakespeare's has a theatrical imagination, a ballet of Romeo and Juliet, which follows the same narrative and scenic structure as the play, is still very much Romeo and Juliet to me. Yep. In a way, I'm in a poor position to judge because I've got the text scrolling in my head anyway when I see these things. But no, Nahum Tate's King Lear is King Lear. It's a viable response to Shakespeare's text. It restores the ending that Shakespeare spoiled, if you want.
I like it better.
Tate can feel the unconscious of the text that Shakespeare is kind of suppressing. Somebody does a jazz improvisation based on Beethoven's Fifth. It does not erase all previous recordings of Beethoven's Fifth. It's fine. It's part of the energy of the thing. Shakespeare's plays are kind of unresolved conversations. They're full of people contradicting each other and speculating about how else it might have turned out. If a producer wants to experiment with some of those other possibilities, I'm not too bothered about it. As long as it's intelligent.
Yeah, the whole idea of there being some kind of pure form, we know from our studies that three early versions of Hamlet, and we can go early versions of Romeo and Juliet that disagree. To find that pure form would be hard to begin with.
And to
think of what we have been inspired by, in people in the Christian world, the Bible in various languages other than English, then the Homeric narratives, any number of classical stories that have been brought to Shakespeare's audience through translation. It is one of these great driving creative forces in the mind of the translator and the minds of the people who receive it, and that it isn't codified, it isn't set in stone, a well-wrought urn, that it isn't that, gives it life from generation to generation.
Absolutely. And the sense that there is, in a way, I'm kind of sawing off a branch that I'm partly perched on, because one of the things that brings people to Stratford is the idea that there is a true Shakespearean authentic tradition. Mm-hmm. Actually, it's a tradition of perpetually throwing away the tradition and trying to start again from somewhere else. Actors of successive generations want to do it differently. They need to speak to a different audience with different concerns and different understandings of what particular gestures and intonations mean. We did not get into the kind of terrible cul-de-sac that the Comédie Française used to be stuck in, where if you were doing Le Malade Imaginaire by Molière, you had to wear exactly the same costumes and make exactly the same gesture at exactly the same point in the same sentence as the original production had, and that had then been imitated year after year after year. I mean, that produced a kind of not even very living fossil.
Yeah, the same
and,
melody.
And that never happened. That never happened in this country. I mean, we were lucky. The Globe got demolished. There was a civil war. People had to treat Shakespeare as raw material for a completely new kind of theatre from the later 17th century onwards, and that's gone on happening. So translating Shakespeare into other contexts, other languages, other places, other religious frameworks has just been a continuation of that. I mean, one of the things I'm doing at the moment is writing an introduction to a Korean Hamlet play called Hamlet Cantabile, where a team of kind of acrobat, minstrel, jugglers, cum gravediggers are reenacting bits of the plot of Hamlet to try and release the spirits of the characters. And they have sort of charged props, which become puppets representing the characters. And it's all conceived of in the framework of Korean shamanism. Mm. The music gestures occasionally towards the idea of a Christian afterlife. The title does. But actually, it's a kind of Korean shamanistic commedia dell'arte that's going on. It's absolutely lovely. The characters are all definitely dead already, but yeah. they still have this lingering ghostly attachment to things and to aspects of their earthly emotions and earthly story, which they still need to go over again. It's a completely different sense of where the boundaries are between this life and the next, and where theatre, how theatre provides a kind of link between them.
Yeah, that liminal connection. How about the preservation and the presentation of this? I know you're writing a book on this, but do you not feel this urge to be able to bring to people what you've seen in some way online or in some way to,
yeah.
you know, there's a resistance to recording around a lot of the world, you know,
yeah.
but you see these things and you wish people could see them with you.
Well, I've never seen that production in person. I know it only through recordings. And again, one of the delights of my life at the moment is that I'm one of the editorial team on the Asian Shakespeare Intercultural Archive, yeah. which just makes available recordings surtitled in four languages, with none of them privileged. You can either have it in Mandarin, in Korean, in Japanese, or in English for the surtitles. But they're good quality video recordings of really interesting productions of Shakespeare from all over Eastern Asia. So Japan, Korea, Vietnam,
yeah.
China.
MIT Global is doing a lot of that.
Yeah.
Also with Alexa yeah. Japan and her.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. But no, this stuff's fascinating. And it's, you know, if there is an overarching Shakespeare tradition, this is all very much part of it. Yeah. To go on rethinking and restaging and producing new variations on these plays. If I go to the theatre in England and it's an English language production, I like hearing. If there are Elizabethan jokes that they can't make funny, I would much rather they cut them. But on the whole, I would like to hear the text audibly, but if it's somewhere else, it's a different game. Translation, as you say, is incredibly vital at renewing and refashioning. And there's that line. Is it Marlowe? Is it the tradition is not the worship of ashes; it is the preservation of flame. There's an awful lot of worship of ashes that goes on around Shakespeare in the English speaking world, I think.
Yeah. Yeah,
a lot of worrying about whether it's real thatch or not, which I think is completely beside the point.
Yeah, well, much of your work has been done with the Arden series on acting, and
yeah.
you are a person, you are a man of action. You like the you like the production, you like the moment, the Shakespearean moment and so forth. I've talked yeah. to critics, of course, and you have people on your faculty and so forth who very much get involved with textual scholarship, and I love
yeah.
that too.
Yeah.
But we all love that moment on the stage and these additions that are lauded by actors who let's talk about that just a bit.
Yeah, yeah. It's performance. Yeah. I mean, I don't want to do the kind of scholarship which I think is in other people are doing better than I would. I do not want to produce an edition of Shakespeare. I think there are too many editions of Shakespeare in the world. I think too much of our profession is bribed to produce yet more undergraduate introductions to Midsummer Night's Dream that say much the same thing as each other. It's the same play. I mean, there are already a lot of copies of Midsummer Night's Dream out there. But that said, I prefer it if actors know what they're talking about, know what they're saying when they do Shakespeare, and know which bits are Shakespeare and which bits have been stuck in by editors later.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I want actors not to think, oh, it says somewhere another room in the palace, so therefore, you know, we need to move a chair. And I want them to know that, you know, it could be sullied or solid because we've got early printings of both, you know,
solid and sullied in Hamlet.
Yeah.
The soliloquy in Hamlet. Yes.
Exactly. You know, that there are variations between the quarto texts and the folio texts at some points, and you could choose either, mm-hmm. or you could cut both. You know, it's up to you. So this Arden series, instead of being, you know, the latest, whatever it is, Arden 6 or the, you know, the fully textually annotated, showing where every editor has moved every comma since Shakespeare's lifetime, which, you know, Tiffany is partly in charge of, Tiffany Stern at the
Tiffany
Institute,
Stern, yeah.
which is, you know, a massive and important scholarly enterprise. What our editorial team, which is me, Abigail Rokerson Woodall at the Institute, and Simon Russell Beale, who's a very learned actor and a very good actor, what we're doing is making a properly edited text of Shakespeare. In other words, you know, this has been thought about by scholars. This, you know, we've taken out the misprints in the early quartos and folios, and we give you the text as, you know, as decided in a previous fully annotated Arden. And all we do is explain what the words mean as simply and quickly as possible, show where the legitimate variants are that an actor might find useful, and leave lots of space on the opposite page among the notes where actors can scribble notes about where they need to stand, yeah. Or anything else during rehearsal. We absolutely don't tell them what the play is supposed to mean. These are just to make the words clear and show them how to pronounce the classical names that a lot of young actors have never heard spoken, like Pericles, and, you know, how many and where the stresses might go, you know, how you can actually say this stuff without getting yourself into a tangle, you know, if you follow this, you know, kind of where, you know, if we can show you where the rhythm is.
Right.
So it's got metrical notes, it's got a basic glossary, it shows you how to pronounce the names. And otherwise, it just gives actors a good, clean, reliable text, and leaves them to get on with it.
Yeah. What a great thing to do. And I did want to get into a discussion with you about, I'm bringing up my notes right now, I threw out some things because well, I think both of us are a little bit all over the place in a good way, because you're very interested. You've done work on public sphere and reception, and I'm very much into that. I have some little unread articles here or there that I'm very interested in it. And I can, I told a friend of mine that I'm going to try to patent what I'm writing as a cure for insomnia, and that will be my my retirement fund. And
we have the insomnia so that our readers won't.
That's right. And I, you know, when I have trouble sleeping, I just read what I've written. But the thing is, though, that you do reception theory, and particularly from Garrett on out. And I think that's what we've been talking about all along, though, really, how Shakespeare lands in Ukraine, how it lands in China, Japan. And I know from the Japanese perspective, there is no sense that I can find. There is in academe, maybe in small groups, this idea of an iconic Shakespeare. Mm-hmm. But in anything that we, any example, Ninagawa or Kurosawa or any of those examples, there's no sense that you are not free to move things beyond.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. No, I mean, what interests me is how Shakespeare means for people and for different groups of people, and the shared understanding of Shakespeare, and then these shared disruptions of that understanding of Shakespeare, wherever that may be happening. You know, one of the things about all those footnotes in all the scholarly editions that we grew up with, saying, well, this is what this word meant in 1597, and therefore, you know, for whom did it mean that? You know, it's really only when you get after Shakespeare's period that there are enough written down responses to Shakespeare, paintings based on Shakespeare, ballads based on Shakespeare, all these music composed around or for Shakespeare or about Shakespeare, that there's actually a really rich evidence about how people are making sense of this stuff, where it fits into their world. You know, I think obsessing about what it might or might not have meant in the 1590s, again, it's something that has, you know, that kind of meticulous antiquarianism, that sort of historicism, which so much teaching of Shakespeare at undergraduate level in the English speaking world gets, it seems to me to be a, you know, gets preoccupied with. It seems to me to be a kind of sidetrack. The important thing about these plays is not their resemblances or lack of resemblance to some boring pamphlets that may or may not have actually sold any copies in 1592. It's the excitement that they continue to inspire for generations and generations of actors and theatergoers and readers.
Yeah. Well, in many ways, when you pick up on Garrick and you take Shakespeare into the 19th and 20th centuries, you're talking about a type of translation. Things change so quickly. And when I try to teach in English to my students in Japan, of course, I want them to try to encounter the English language because that's what we do. I mean, it's English literature. But in the end, I just want them to take away from what, you know, these themes and meanings and so forth. But there's so much there that is already to the English speaking world, you have to translate. Yeah. I didn't ride a horse to school today.
Exactly. You know, this is a Jacobean house, but I'm very glad that it's got electricity.
And other things too.
Yes.
So in the future, though, we can expect to see from you this maybe a listing of how Shakespeare is used. I was interested in how you picked national theater repertories, and that would be, let's talk a little bit. It's probably boring, but let's talk a little bit about funding and how you get things to the stage.
Well, I mean, and again, that's one reason for writing about national theaters is they have funding. And the very fact that they have funding partly conditions what they do and conditions what it means, whether they intend it to mean that or not. And again, part of the condition of national theatre funding, alas, is the obsolescence of theatre as a medium of mass entertainment. Yeah. You only get subsidised theatre when commercial theatre has dwindled to, you know, large musicals. Once the cinema has really, and then television and streaming have become the way people actually get entertained, then that's when the state feels, oh well, but this is we need to invest in our nation's high culture to prove that we're still here and to prove that we're still serious and to maintain a certain industry which feeds possibly profitable musicals. You know, I mean, the RSC continues to get funding on the basis that it produces the occasional film star and people who and occasionally produces Matilda. That it's engaged in the commercial stuff as well. And it's also mixed up with notions of education that, we need to teach all our citizens that they all dislike being taught Shakespeare so that they'll at least have that in common. It's sort of part of it. And arts funding in this country, which is dwindling even more rapidly now than it has been, is very much tied to sort of social work objectives. You know, we will fund you to stage Shakespeare as long as you can prove you're staging it for groups who don't actually like Shakespeare and wouldn't come to it unless you took special pains, unless you are definitely bringing in people who wouldn't spontaneously have come to the theater anyway, then we aren't going to pay you to do it. We'll pay you that little bit that enables you to gives you seed funding so that you can then ask for corporate sponsorship to cover the rest. So national theaters have funding. That means they have archives, which depending on the history of different bits of the world may or may not have survived World War I, World War II, whatever other wars there may have been there. And again, it's that sense that the English case happens sort of to Shakespeare, you know, that one of the things that his colleagues think is special about Shakespeare is that he bothers to write chronicle plays. You know, it's comedies, histories, and tragedies, rather than, as with Beaumont and Fletcher, just comedies and tragedies. When you get into the folio, that sense that one of the significant things about Shakespeare is that he takes English kings quite seriously as material, and that therefore other theatre traditions also translate Shakespeare and they produce pastiche Shakespearean plays about their own histories that often go into the repertory alongside Shakespeare in various fascinating ways. You know, it's that 19th through early 20th century sort of moment of these different, what get called national awakenings in a optimistic way. And the different ways in which they find Shakespeare useful. I have to say that the trajectory of this book is changing very rapidly while I'm writing it because of the way the world's changing.
Yeah.
When I first planned this book, it was going to be, which is some time ago when I actually started doing bits of research, really just as a side effect of being in different places that had these fantastic and interesting archives that I went and visited. It was going to be a book about how the movement towards national theatres was now sort of dwindling because there were now these great cosmopolitan international Shakespeare festivals that much of the best live performances of Shakespeare nowadays one sees not at the National or the RSC in the British Isles, but at the Edinburgh Festival. Mm-hmm. And, you know, During the happy times in the early 21st century, the Gdansk Theatre was being built, the Gdansk International Shakespeare Festival. Jerzy Limon set up the European Shakespeare Festivals Network, this whole set of wonderful, massive events, which, you know, formed an association. Craiova in Romania, Julia in Hungary, Avignon in France, you know, these festivals where different theatre companies from all over the world, including Asia, would come. And the thing that they would have in common was that all the shows you saw were, to a greater or lesser extent, based on Shakespeare in all these different languages. That, and those, to me, were utopia. I mean, if I could live at the Craiova Shakespeare Festival permanently, I would die of exhaustion because I would never sleep, but that would be a great way to go. You know, it's just, you know, I've had absolutely fabulous times seeing different productions of Shakespeare. I mean, in 2010, the Craiova Festival had an entire theatre festival that was all Hamlet. It was one utterly different Hamlet after another from all over the world. There was a no theatre Hamlet. There were Polish Hamlets, German Hamlets, Ostermeyer's Hamlet. You know, it was just extraordinary and wonderful. Wow. So I was originally writing this optimistic book about the rise and fall of nationalism and how, you know, in the arts, cosmopolitanism was taking over and you know, how China was opening up. We set up our Shakespeare Center in China. I went to Russia. I went in the Russian State Archive. I worked with the Moscow Arts Theater, brilliant production of Merchant of Venice that Ekaterina Polovtseva did. And now that is sort of gone massively into reverse. Well, it's been going massively into reverse for the last, I don't know, 10 years. I'm no longer a citizen of the European Union. You know, I can't go to Russia. I can't go to China. You know, and the Julia Theatre Festival in Hungary, the Hungarian government has said, no, we will no longer support this festival unless it only performs in Hungarian. You know, it's that in that kind of tribal language based, you know, unpleasant authoritarian nationalism that's took over in Hungary. A lot of the theatre directors I know in Poland got fired because they weren't Catholic enough. You know, it's going to be a much more depressing book, I think, than I hoped it would be.
Oh, and throw a pandemic on top of everything.
Yeah, quite, yeah.
Oh my, it will be, but you know, these things I think maybe swing back and forth, and we can only hope for
a better world. Let's hope.
a better role.
Indeed.
I do feel that when we're talking about public funding, I bored people to tears with my views on this, and I won't do this now. But even at the very beginning, with the Revels office in the 16th century, there was a collaboration. I've done research recently on it. We know this. There's a collaboration between the crown, you know, the very, you know, they had money, and and also the commercial theater. They worked together, and it's very clear. The separation, I think Tiffany Stern remarks on this, the separation between what we consider to be the aristocratic crown and also the people, the populace who came to these theaters. There was a fairly close relationship, and they worked together.
Absolutely.
And shared resources on this.
No, it was always a mixed economy. It was you don't get a massive explosion and wonderful explosion of creative theatre unless the whole society is more or less going along with it. Mm-hmm. You know, the notion that everybody who went to church hated the playhouses and the government were only anxious about whether they were seditious or not just isn't true. You know, lots and lots of people were really into it.
And remain so.
Yeah.
Well, what I would like to do now is you've traveled recently. I want to hear about your recent travels. You've been to Italy, I believe.
Yes. Yes. I
went to Italy. You're one of, we have another speaker coming on who has been to Italy. Italy seems to be a place to go. So
I can't, why wouldn't it be? I mean, it's really nice going to Italy. I mean, actually, some of the research I was doing there was partly, something of a side issue, rather than being about the Nationalism and National Theatres book, though partly I was solemnly doing my job in that the Institute has a collaboration with the University of Verona. Mm-hmm. Verona is going to be the host of the next World Shakespeare Congress in 2026, which will be terrific. It's a lovely city. I'm very fond of Verona. Shakespeare didn't go to these places, so I think we need to go on his behalf, you know, to try and compensate the poor man. And there's a summer school run in Verona by Silvia Biliazzi and her team called the Shakespeare in the Mediterranean Summer School. And masters and research students can come to it from all over the place, and they study a particular play. And this year it was The Tempest, so, you know, I taught seminars on The Tempest there, and there's a fringe festival that's now part of the European Shakespeare Festivals network, so there are Shakespeare's there. There was a very beautiful, very small cast Ukrainian Midsummer Night's Dream that was on, among other things, which was splendid. But one of the things I was also doing in Italy with my wife, Professor Nicola Watson, who was also teaching on the summer school, was we were interested in grottos. I've got very interested in grottos, and this again partly comes out of that first book of mine that and thank you for having read it, you know, thousands haven't, because I, as you may recall, identified some of the members of the Shakespeare Ladies Club, this gang of aristocratic women who campaigned for there to be more Shakespeare on in the 1730s, and their ringleader I established was the Countess of Shaftesbury. I was sent an article to read a couple of years ago by Shakespeare Survey to peer review anonymously, that was by a Canadian master's student who had discovered that the aristocratic house where the Countess of Shaftesbury used to live was in the process of being restored by the current Earl of Shaftesbury. And they published a book about the restoration project, which include quotations showing that the Countess of Shaftesbury had not only helped fund the putting of the statue of Shakespeare in Westminster Abbey, but had bought the model for that statue and had built a little temple for it in her garden, which was equipped with glass cases full of the works of Shakespeare, so that you could go and sit in the world's first temple of Shakespeare. You know, this is before Garrick built one for himself. And you could read Shakespeare at the feet of this statue of Shakespeare in her allegorical landscaped gardens. I thought it was fabulous and they should print it. And I've met this student. She's very good, Genevieve Kirk. I was really quite annoyed because 30 years ago, I wrote to the Earl of Shaftesbury saying, look, I've identified one of your ancestors as this really important cultural figure. Can I come and look in your library, see if there's any evidence there and find out? And I got no response because at that time, the house was more or less derelict. The then Earl of Shaftesbury was on the south of France being murdered by his wife. There was then a lawsuit about the succession, and it wasn't sorted out for years. But last summer, my wife and I wrote to the current Earl of Shaftesbury, and we actually went to the site of where this temple of Shakespeare was. Sadly, it's not there now, though some of the other temples and garden buildings survive. But the interesting thing to me, or one of the striking things, was that this temple of Shakespeare had been lined with seashells, and some of the documents refer to it as Shakespeare's cell, which makes it sound as though it wasn't exactly your average summer house or 18th century temple, but was more like a grotto. And since in Westminster Abbey, Shakespeare is pointing to a quotation from The Tempest, our revels now are ended, this looks like Prospero's cell, and that it looks like kind of Shakespeare's grotto come Prospero's cell, which identifies Shakespeare with water, with the underworld, with the unconscious. You know, that's a really exciting thing. So while we were in Italy, having taught The Tempest in Verona, Nikki and I arranged to hire a car, a very perilous thing to do in Italy because the driving really is as dangerous as everybody says, and worked our way down from Verona to Rome via a whole series of Renaissance gardens that really set the template for landscape gardens all over Europe, and looking at grottos, and some of which are absolutely extraordinary places, and you know, thinking about what having a little dark, wet hole at the bottom of your garden with a statue of something in it has meant.
Michael, the sacrifices we have to make for our research.
Yeah. And of course, we were on the move, so we had to eat in the best restaurants in Italy every night, you know, because we couldn't cook for ourselves. It was hell. You know, all that Valpolicella Ripasso, you know, it doesn't bear thinking about. It was tough, as it sometimes is. I mean, it was. I have to say that some of my research travels have not been like that. I mean, my tour of the Ukraine, which was absolutely wonderful, was partly funded by the British Council, which doesn't have, you know, they I think they were feeling petulant because they'd just been thrown out of Russia after the Skripal poisoning. So they funded me to go to Ukraine, but they don't have much money. So they noticed that overnight trains are cheaper than hotels. So I spent quite a lot of time on overnight trains across Ukraine, which was fabulous. I mean, you turn out to, it turns out that most Ukrainians travel on overnight trains in order to have parties. Rather than to sleep.
Yeah, it depends on the train. It's what I'm thinking.
I think it can, but it's not a recipe for getting much sleep anyway. That was Italy. Since then, I've been to the Craiova Festival in Romania, which has managed to revive. It was its first in-person iteration since the pandemic, so it was very important that it should go well. A much smaller geographical range of productions, because you know, nothing from Asia really. It was mainly European companies. I saw some terrific stuff. Oscar Kusanawas's new Othello, among other things. And then I went up to Gdansk in Poland for a big memorial event in honor of Jerzy Limon, who built that theater and who was a friend of mine and who sadly died of COVID before there were vaccinations available in Poland. So that was a big sort of 2-day conference about Jerzy's achievements and the directions in which they might go, and the theatre he built, which was, you know, marvelous and beautifully staged, largely by Justina, his widow. Since then, the end of last month, I sadly had to go to New York. Because the Institute, among other things, is the custodian of a rather good art collection. You know, we have some nice picks, including we've recently begun being stewards of Barry Jackson's collection of Dame Laura Knight paintings, including wonderful, a whole set of wonderful paintings from backstage from his production of the first History Tetralogy, which are great. But the really kind of talismanic painting at the Shakespeare Institute is the portrait of the Moorish ambassador to the court of Elizabeth I. This Moroccan diplomat who was sent to try and negotiate an alliance between Protestant England and Muslim Morocco to reconquer the south of Catholic Spain and take over the West Indies and the East Indies. This was the master plan, which, you know, how different world history might have been, but it didn't happen. But he came to London, and it's a wonderful portrait, which Allardyce Nichols spotted when it came up for auction in the 50s, and the university bought for a price a lot lower than it would fetch now. Anyway, there's a huge exhibition of Tudor portraiture and other Tudor things at the Metropolitan Museum of Art in New York, and they borrowed the Moorish ambassador.
Okay.
So I, you know, a little delegation from the University of Birmingham went over and I gave talks about the painting. The Moroccan consul to New York came and met the painting and it was grand. There were various events around it. And that exhibition is moving on to Cleveland, Ohio, that lovely big art museum in Cleveland.
Yes.
And then to the big art museum in San Francisco before the Moorish ambassador returns to Stratford. But it is a wonderful portrait. And Ben Kingsley based his costume on it when he played Othello with David Suchet as Iago in, whatever that was, 1982, around then. So that's what I was doing there. And I came back by the south of France because, you know, sometimes one just has to.
Well, you get diverted. You know, you have to make these sacrifices and travel.
It's true. But it's one of our collaborations is with the Institut pour Recherche sur la Renaissance, l'Arche Classique et les Lumières, which is the research institute that was set up in Montpellier.
By Jean-Marie.
Jean-Marie Magin came to the institute as a visiting lecturer for a year in the late 60s, and he thought, well, we should have one of these in France. I should set up an institute for study of the Renaissance in France, and that's what the IRCL grew from.
And Montpellier, you know, when the French put their mind to do something, you see it in Montpellier.
The new site,
and also the preserved old city. Just fabulous stuff.
And has all sorts of fascinating histories overlapping on it. The greatest medical school in Europe throughout the Middle Ages and the Renaissance and most of the Enlightenment as well. And I'm not qualified to evaluate how good that medical school is now, but I imagine it's still very, very important. But it is a wonderful city. It has a great art gallery with all those courbets in it, which is great Renaissance stuff. Terrific Poussin Venus and Adonis painting, which I'm particularly fond of. Anyway, it was a conference about healing, and cultural representations of healing. Lots of stuff about spas, and I was talking about Pericles, largely because, among other things, I'm a trustee of a theatre company called Flute Theatre, which performs therapeutic Shakespeare, which does drama games, adaptations of Shakespeare designed for audiences on the autistic spectrum. And Pericles, this whole play about reviving people and curing people's famines and bringing people back from the dead and bringing people back from states of torpor and uncommunicability, is just the perfect play for Flute. And they have an absolutely wonderful, they've got a production of it for autistic audiences, and then a 7-actor production of it just for any audience at all, and they're both extraordinary things.
What a wonderful thing. I had not made that connection. It was Pericles. Well, there you are. Well, I think what you're doing is what in the States has been termed as revenge travel. you know, we were set back for a period where we couldn't do it, and now we can, and that's good.
Yeah. Well, we can afford it, which may not be all that long. We shall see. Yeah. And of course, I try to do it by train where I can, though it's not always practicable.
Yeah.
But no, I think diplomacy is very, very important. I think those of us who can read need to show that we are all citizens of the same planet, even if a lot of our leaders are trying to pretend that actually we should be separate cages full of rats struggling over the last few resources rather than collaborating on it. You know, where we can collaborate internationally, we have a kind of duty to set an example of it. Mind the fact that, you know, Shakespeare did become the first author in world literature, that and you can really understand these plays better the more perspectives you can see them from.
Yeah. All of this is just wonderful stuff, and we could go on and on.
We just could because
you know, when you travel to these places and you travel to the conflict zone that seems to be America from the media, and I talked to my students who we were interviewing for entrance to our programs, who spent time in states, say every one of them, they do it every year, they said we had a great time, and this is in Illinois or Mississippi South Florida, and you know, things are not this bad among us. And also, Shakespeare is not that ubiquitously hated. I'm sure there's people who had terrible times with their teachers and so forth, but it's not ubiquitously reviled by.
Absolutely,
so much good stuff going on.
Yeah, fabulous, and it's a conversation. Yeah, the plays are themselves conversations, and. You know, they are very hospitable to people coming and joining in the conversation. You know, that's what it's all been about from the preface to the first folio onwards. No, I don't regret the fact that Shakespeare gets taught compulsorily in English schools, though I wish it were possible to persuade people that the plays weren't written to be obedience tests or citizenship exams. That they're actually, you know, they're playful things that want to think and feel about what it's like to be alive.
Well, you and your colleagues, and I've spoken to several of them, Emma Smith at Oxford and, of course, Tiffany Stern and several others who have really worked to push back on this whole idea of the educational Shakespeare and the schoolmaster with his stick in his hand and that kind of thing, you know, what we could something out of Dickens or something like that. And that this is just not the shape of things now. And it's not the shape of the great institutions in the UK, the Western branch of the new branch of the Oxford Library is very open to the public. And the Folger is just, renovated and producing, responding to this idea of bringing the public in and making sure people feel that they have a stake in this too. And
absolutely.
This is all that, this is your work, you know, in your position. And I guess somewhat mine, maybe over here in Tokyo. What I'd like to do is bring things to a close because we're keeping you from doing that work right now. And I'd like you to stay a moment after we finish recording.
We can
break just a moment. Michael, my colleagues over here, my students, everyone, and also our international audience and growing a little bit. And we're just going to be so happy that you came on and you took time to speak with us today. And thank you again so much.
Oh, it's an absolute pleasure. You know, I look forward to the next time we can speak in person, wherever that may be. And if somebody wants to fund me to get across Asia by train to Japan to talk with you, I'm game. You know, count me in.
We might be able to talk about that. We'll see. We'll see. Okay. Thank you again so much.